This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
Let's start back with your origin story. You know, sure. I understand that you were part of the Operation Baby Lift. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I was born in 1971, obviously during the Vietnam War. At the age of two, I contracted polio, which left me paralyzed from the waist down. My natural parents then abandoned me, literally, on the streets of Saigon, and I was taken in by an orphanage. They cared for me for a few years until 1975, the day literally before the fall of Saigon, the United States executed Operation Baby Lift. And what that operation was it was to airlift Vietnamese orphans from Vietnam to then be adopted to American parents. And I remember the day pretty vividly. It was very chaotic. I remember a lot of the orphanage people, staff, just trying to scramble to get these orphans on these planes. It was so chaotic that my records and my braces were placed on the plane I was supposed to be on, which is the first one. And then I got mixed up and thrown on the second plane. Well, as it would have it, the first plane took off and it crashed. So nearly every orphan on that plane perished, if you remember the articles. And then I successfully flew, or safely flew, to the United States.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's I think 149 people on that plane, 141 died.
Yeah.
And most of them were the babies.
Yeah.
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 I mean, just imagine the coincidence, you know.
Well, you know, for me, I grew up a person of faith, so I truly felt that it was God's destiny, certainly, to bring me over to the United States to, you know, to fulfill a purpose that he had for me. Of course, I didn't know what that purpose was until probably most recently as being named a Orange County Department of Education superintendent. And so just reflecting back on my life, certainly I could see that along the way, it led to where I am today. So
your last name is Bean, from mom and dad who adopted you.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about these people?
Yeah. So when I arrived in the United States, Gregory and Judy Bean met me for the first time. They took me in as a foster child. And then several years later, they were able to adopt me. Great, amazing people. So my adopted mother, Judy, had such a heart and compassion for the most vulnerable students or children.
Yeah.
And they took in over 150 foster children at birth to like 14, 16 years old. And many of them actually had disabilities. I grew up in a rather large family. They adopted 10 of us. They had two of their own, adopted 10 of us.
Wow.
And the 10 of us, several of us had disabilities. I have twin brothers have autism. I did have a brother who passed away at two because he was severely beaten by his natural parents.
Yeah.
So Judy Bean was amazing. And then Gregory Bean, my dad, was actually a sixth grade teacher.
Yeah.
So he provided us, you know, what he could based on a sixth grade teacher salary.
And when you were growing up, did you think about the actual country that you came from? Did you ever stop and go, wait a minute, I'm in a completely different place now?
Of course. You know, when I came over, I only spoke Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And I remember my parents telling me I would just nonstop speak Vietnamese because nobody could understand me. And so I would get frustrated, just continue speaking Vietnamese until I thought somebody could understand. They did stay very connected with a Vietnamese family that actually came over at the same time. So they're in the same city and same town. So we met there often, weekly, just so I could communicate with somebody. And so through that family, I was able to at least understand, okay, the culture that I'm in now is different, obviously, than the culture I came from. And then I remember in eighth grade receiving a scholarship from a Vietnamese organization in San Diego, and meeting lots of people. And of course, from that point on, I wondered, you know, what is my heritage about? And so I planned to one day go back. In fact, for the 50th anniversary of the Operation Baby Lift, so my kids and I will be going back there next year.
I don't even know what to say. Yeah. That gets me really emotional to think about that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, it was a struggle, certainly, coming to a new culture, not speaking the language. And I tell people all the time that my schooling was not really good for me. I mean, they put me in classrooms away from the mainstream because at that time they didn't know how to really educate a child with disability. They tried to teach me English, and it just didn't work out well until sixth grade when I met Mr. Geisinger. And he was a teacher that really saw through the challenges that I had, and he didn't see them as deficits. And he saw the strengths that I had, and he said, "Stefan, what I want you to do is just give oral presentations on the things that you learn this whole year. You don't have to write anything. You don't have to take tests. Just give oral presentations." And so that alone,
holy cow.
Yeah, I'm getting choked up just thinking about it. But that alone obviously built my communication skills in English. And then here I am today. From there, actually, then that was in sixth grade. And because he, just a very simple act like that, sawing the strengths within me, because he learned I had, he knew I had this gift of gab. So he said, just speak in English. And give these presentations. It actually springboard into an invitation to Washington, D.C. to speak in front of 15,000 people on behalf of the disabled. And that was at 14. And that was because of Mr. Geisinger. So,
do you know who Viet Dinh is?
No.
He's general counsel over at Fox Corporation for like 20 years.
Really?
Yeah, big wig, just right under Murdoch and Lachlan over there.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and I had interviewed him, and he talked about the sort of similar experience. Ninth grade, he went up to give a speech, and he buckled, and he basically ran out of the room.
Oh, wow.
And then he asked the teacher, what could he do? Because if he's paralyzed from that experience, he's not going to be able to do anything.
Yeah.
So he took up the challenge. This teacher said, you should take my debate class or whatever. And he did that. And then he excelled as a result of debate.
Awesome.
And just very similar to your story, these teachers and educators have so much to do with pivoting the directions in our lives.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I'm in education, honestly, is I've seen so many teachers that those who are successful and make good connections are the ones that see the strengths and the assets in the kids. Versus, you know, you have some bad teachers, some certainly. Those are the ones that think of students in a really negative way, right? And in a deficit perspective. And so I took that and made it who I am as an educator, an educational leader.
You know, I want to go back to your mom and dad. Yeah. Fascinating to me because you hear about foster parents not being the best people. There's a lot of cases.
Sure.
That are like that. Different motives, different intentions, ulterior motives. But it sounds like the people that you happen to come in your life were just solid people.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of energy
to
take care of 11 kids for two people.
12 kids, actually.
12 kids.
Yeah.
And it's not like just 12 kids that are running around.
Right.
They're kids with, disabilities that they have to handle. Like, where do you think that comes from?
Well, to your point, it really does take an individual with an empathetic heart. And both of my parents had that, meaning that they truly cared for, truly made us feel significant, and truly taught us the strengths and benefits of community. And so together, the brothers and sisters just supported the family. So, of course, you had older kids who then I would say the first six kids were really truly raised by our parents. And then the younger six were raised by all of us. And so that's how you do it, right, is in a large family like
that.
Got
it. So the older ones were really there for infrastructure.
Yeah, the older ones really were responsible and cared for the younger.
Are you still close to your siblings?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's all from San Diego?
Most of them still live in San Diego. Several of us live, within California. One lives in Chicago. But many of my siblings grew up to be very successful individuals. I mean, one became the fire chief in Chula Vista. Mm. One became a physician's assistant who does surgeries every day. So, again, that's the dad side who said education is going to help you overcome.
Yeah.
And hold on to that gift. And so.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
There was a time when I was in the Marine Corps and I had a lot of time because I was the desk job that I had in the Marine Corps afforded me a lot of time to pull out library books and read from the base library.
Yeah.
And I was reading a lot of biographies and autobiographies.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people that are successful have parents that are either one educator or two educators. Mm. It's insane the amount of...
It's not a coincidence.
Famous musicians, famous filmmakers, famous creatives, famous anything, politicians, with one or two parents that were teachers. And I always remembered that. It always showed up. I'm saying, for me, in my reading, anecdotally, maybe 70% of these cases of biographies.
Yeah.
And now that I'm interviewing people, I always feel like there's always one or two educators as parents.
And if not that, then always somebody in education that impacts the success of a child. Absolutely. I would agree with you with that.
What made you pivot into education? Because you studied business admin in undergrad.
Yeah, interesting enough, when I was in high school, Family Ties, right? I don't know. Family Ties used to be the great TV show. And I wanted to be an Alex P. Keaton, right? Michael J. Fox character. And so I was very business oriented in high school. And same at USC. So from sixth grade on, I was able to get straight A's because of Mr. Geisinger, which then led to scholarships to get into USC. And I went through the entrepreneurship program with the intention to run my own business. So wrote a couple of business plans and then actually did start my own business right out of USC. We owned a software company.
Oh, wow.
And it was so amazing. It's so funny because I tell people this all the time. Yeah, the group of programmers that worked for us actually developed a collaborative platform that you could access online anywhere in the world and start typing in real time and see those changes. So we pitched it, and a lot of the companies said, we don't think the bandwidth is there for this to be successful. So kid you not, what, 12 years later, boom.
Google Docs,
right? But anyway, so that was successful for a little bit. And then it just didn't feel right for me, in terms of giving back to the community. It was more like trying to really hustle and try to be successful and try to earn lots of money because of running a business. And so it didn't feel like, well, this is not my sweet spot. I'm not giving back like my parents did. Because I really have a very empathetic leadership style. And so when I met my wife at USC, Janet, and I asked her out three times, and she said no three times. And she said, Stefan, the reason why I'm saying no is because I'm here to learn more about God, and I'm here to get a degree, so I have no time for you. I said, okay. And so it was probably 3 or 4 years after USC that we started dating. And she had a family crisis where her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. So we together moved up to Lemoore area, which is by Fresno. And at that moment, it was a great natural break from business just to go up and care for her mother and be there for Janet. And then so I decided I was going to go and get my teaching credential. And so I did while we were up there, got my teaching credential, then taught. And then after that, of course, I used my business background to wanted to really lead leaders. And so to lead leaders, you have to go through being a principal. And then I became a director, and then I became an associate superintendent and then a superintendent of a district in Los Angeles of 11 charter
schools. Which district?
So it's Aspire Public Schools. Mm. It's a charter network of schools. We had 11 campuses, and I ran them. But to answer your question, that's really what got me into education, is this desire to serve our community and care for our community, and in the process making that natural switch when I went up to help my at that time fiance, but now.
You know, I do want to talk about that time that your fiance and Janet, you know, men of our age, Vietnamese men of our age have this sort of, I'm speaking from my own experience and some of my friends, most of my friends who are my age, men, we have this sort of dent in our armor when it comes to confidence in those days, in the 90s. Many of us have grown out of it.
Yeah.
But I look at your pictures with your girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
She's a beautiful woman.
Yeah, thank you.
You're a handsome man.
Yeah, thank you.
But you're in a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah.
And I keep thinking about the strength that it takes to ask somebody out. Mm. That, at the, you know, she's beautiful. And the confidence it takes to really land a date with somebody like that.
Yeah.
So can you tell me about the psychological sort of like, did you have those kind of insecurities as not only as an Asian man, but somebody who has a disability?
Of course, man. Of course.
And how'd you overcome all that?
Double so, right?
I mean,
not just because I was an Asian man in a very Caucasian school, both in high school and in college, obviously, but... the disability too. I thought about that all of my childhood. Like, was I going to be able to get married, find a girlfriend? And I think really what helped me to overcome that was I just persevere, right? I overcome. I'm really resilient. And so even though Janet said no to me literally 3 times, I thought to myself, that's all right. We'll keep trying. And then when I saw her 3 years later, actually... I tease her, and we tease each other because she was the one that made the first move. You know, 3 years later, really? When we met up at a friend's wedding. So we went to a friend's wedding together, and
you keep in touch in those 3 years?
Yeah, we did. We were good friends, so we kept in touch. And then she was the one who made the first move. You know, before that, I certainly had probably 2 serious girlfriends. Not for as long as I had with Janet, obviously. And so I don't know what it was. Yes, I was definitely insecure about my disability, but I was very confident about myself, if that makes sense.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And so...
And that shows through, actually, in the pictures.
Yeah.
The vibe shows that it's a very confident guy.
Yeah.
And it seems like you worked out and, you know, you got the guns and, you know...
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I was, you know, in college, I was a charmer, right? So I just... All you have to do is just really smile and be energetic, and people gravitate to
you. But you got to forget the insecurities. You got to kind of have to.
You're absolutely right, man. You got to go. And that's funny because you say that because after I meet people and then I get to know them for even just 20 or 30 minutes, they forget the fact that I'm in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Because they tell me that. They go, and then oftentimes when we do things, they forget that I'm in a wheelchair. And so you're absolutely right. Once they get past that first 5 minutes and then get to know who you are, that's what actually exudes, right? So Janet, she was the one who made that first move, and we've been just we were so blessed for the 20 years we were married.
And then you guys have all, you know, four kids and life goes on and you're continuing this education.
So interesting. I'll tell you a couple stories. One is interesting. The moment I knew that Janet was for me, we were picnicking at the Kern River. The Kern River is very, it flows pretty hard. So we sat on the bank, and as we were enjoying my lunch, my wheelchair starts to roll down the bank, and it literally goes into the river. God. Next thing I see is this blur, and it's Janet, my girlfriend at the time, just running, and then jumps into the Kern River, which is flowing pretty strong, and the water's going up to here, and she reaches down, and she pulls the sucker out.
Wow.
And she pulls it up to me, and I kid you not, this is exactly what happened. And then I just realized, wow, if a woman would just not even think about caring for me like that, that's the woman to marry. So after that, I proposed to her. We got married in 2000. And then we... excuse me. And I get a little... emotional because... And I'll tell you why in a couple of seconds. But before that, we have four beautiful kids. And... the doctors literally told my parents I couldn't have kids. Stefan's never going to have kids because they didn't know the extent of what polio could do, right? And so I was paralyzed and they didn't think I was functioning. So they told my parents I would never have kids. Well, Jen and I get married. And then within 10 years of our marriage, we have four beautiful kids. So I kid them because they're half Vietnamese and they're half Portuguese. Beautiful combination, by the way.
Yeah.
And so we raised them well. And then in 2014, Janet starts to experience these really severe migraines. So we go to the doctors, and literally for 6 months, they kept saying, there's nothing wrong. You just have severe migraines, so go to the migraine clinic. So, of course, that didn't work. So just coincidence, or I don't know, it was definitely God. She went to an ophthalmologist. And they looked in her eyes, and immediately he took his prescription pad and wrote MRI stat and said, take this to the doctors. So we went, and she got a scan, and on her way home, got a media call, come back, turn the car around. So we went back, and the doctor showed us the film of the MRI, and she had over 12 tumors in her brain. God. In her brain. And so the doctor said to us that the prognosis is not good and that she has about 6 months to live. Later, they biopsied a swollen lymph node and discovered that it was metastatic breast cancer. So it was breast cancer that bypassed the breast and went straight up to the brain. And so this type of breast cancer does that, actually. Goes to the central nervous system. So they said she has 6 months. We're praying people. And so Janet, the next day, looked at me and said, look, you know, God told me I've got extended years. So literally she fought for a good 6 years. She turned that 6 months into 6 years. I would say probably five of those years were really good. The last year, of course, was very difficult because she didn't die from the cancer. She died...
chemo.
Not even the chemo, but the radiation, the whole brain radiation just is like a nuclear bomb.
Fries you, yeah.
Yeah. So as the years go on, the brain dies. And that's what happened in 2020. So she passed away from that. And I say that those 6 years were a blessing because those are six very pivotal years of my children. I think my oldest, when she was diagnosed, was 12, and my youngest was only 4. So then fast forward 6 years, my 4-year-old got at least another 6 solid years with her mom. And so we were blessed to have those 6 years. Very difficult, of course. And then...
but I can imagine how it shapes them or reshapes them, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, now we're not messing around with life.
Nope.
Now you don't have to really say much and do much to kind of put them.
That's right.
Right?
That's just. You're exactly right. I mean, you're very insightful because people ask me, how are you single father of four? And I say, because my kids are very responsible, resilient, and overcomers, and they can handle themselves very well.
Once they see that, I mean, mm-hmm. dad's been at this for 6 years in a wheelchair, and we're still going.
Yep. That's exactly right. So my kids are amazing kids.
Yeah.
You know, I have a, my oldest just graduated USC. So, followed in the footsteps of her parents, which is amazing. And then I told my other kids, okay, I'm not sending you any of you to private colleges again. So choose other colleges. So my second oldest is going to UC Berkeley.
Oh, wow.
Which is much more affordable than USC.
And arguably a better school.
Look, we're all Trojans here.
I love that. It's harder to get in. I mean, let's face it.
You're right. UC schools. Yep. That is true. So she's there studying pre-law. And then I have my son is going to be a senior at Los Alamitos High School. And then my daughter, youngest daughter, will be eighth grade in Los Alamitos also.
You know, I want to ask you, I can understand why you are religious. I get it.
Yeah.
It's very clear to me. And my parents were very religious as well. Yeah. I am not. I could say that I understand and I'm empathetic towards religion.
Yeah.
And I used to fight it a lot until I had to really say, calm down. This is my own issue. I have to come to grips with not fighting religious people just because I'm fighting that war internally with my mom and dad.
Sure.
That legacy. So, so all that being said, I wanted to ask you though, your outward platform is very religious, very, you know, centered around God.
Yeah.
And I think Orange County is a very conservative, very religious.
Well, it's actually more purple than you would think.
Oh, really?
It really is.
Okay.
Yeah, very. It's purple. I wouldn't say it's as deep blue as LA County, of course.
Yeah.
But it's certainly purple.
So, but I've always wondered, and I wanted to talk to you just openly about religion and school and people who are religious in schools.
Yeah.
My girlfriend partner is actually a principal at an elementary school, but she's on the other side. She's more of a, you know, agnostic and not very religious. But when I see leaders like you in schools and platforms that you guys have, I wonder how that feeling of like LGBT, transgender indoctrination, all of those things play into your decision making and sort of living on the line of separation of church and state.
Of course. Well, first of all, so I wouldn't say I'm religious and doing religious practices. I'm actually more what we call like a believer, right? So certainly believe in God. And certainly believe that he has had a hand in my life. And I grew up understanding that in Christianity, my religion, believes that, you know what, we live in a very broken world. And you can see that. You can see that in my life. The things that I had to overcome and challenge. And many people would say, well, how could you let your... How could a God that loves you actually... Yeah. have all those calamities that you've had to face, right? I could easily, after my wife's passing, said, there's no God.
Yeah.
God wouldn't allow that, right? But that's the point of Christianity, is that we live in a very broken world and that we need saving. But the central message is that actually in this broken world, that's when we have to actually love more and we actually have to give more grace to people. And that's the message of Christianity, is loving and giving grace. And so people would be surprised that as a leader in education, if we approach the way we educate in that way, through the lens of love, caring, and looking at people's strengths, that's all we focus on. My central belief of education is education is intended to teach kids new knowledge and old knowledge and teach them to be critical thinkers of that knowledge to then inform them in the decisions they have to make in the future, right? And become productive citizens. That's all education really is. And so if you stand behind that platform, as many educators do, nobody's going to argue with you because it is about the kids. It's about the students. And you do that first by keeping them safe. I'm a proponent of social-emotional learning. Social-emotional learning is just emotional intelligence. It's just helping kids develop emotional intelligence about their own world and how they navigate their emotions through this world, right? I'm a proponent of that. Many people would be surprised to hear that from me, but that is a educational theory that has existed and based on research. Also, another educational theory based on research shows, and Hattie had a longitudinal study on this and discovered, or reading over thousands of studies, that one of the biggest factors of student success is parent involvement and engagement.
Absolutely.
Right? And 95% of the educators that I work with would not disagree with me. We need to have parents involved.
Yeah.
Where I think what you're getting at is, so for instance, the LGBTQ community, I warmly welcome them because I love people. We must care and love for all people. People make their own choices. Christians don't stop that. We're called to love people. We may disagree on certain things, but that's okay. Many people disagree on lots of things. But if we stand to our core mission of love and caring for people, then we're going to see eye to eye. And so I love the people of the LGBTQ community. They have hearts. We may disagree on certain values and things like that, but I'm called to love. And so wherein lies the issues in education is when adults who are the creators of policies, creators of law, creators of programs, when they use those types of topics as a weapon to then make education polarizing. And we already know, you know this by interviewing many people, our nation is polarized.
Yeah.
Right? And yet that has crept into education because people use these issues, hot topic issues, to then build a divide. And I empathize for our teachers and our principals and our leaders because they're caught in the middle of it. Truly, they're high-powered people that use these topics to divide. And now we have these divisions in education. And therefore, you have people that criticize me for having these viewpoints of caring for kids. How is that wrong, right? Educating our kids, how is that wrong? And they don't. If they strip through it, they would realize that I love building relationships and talking to anybody in any position, i.e. right now. I've enjoyed our conversation because we're really just talking about issues of the heart, right? Yeah. And so to answer your question about how do I balance that, my belief in Christianity with the work that I do, it actually drives my work as a Christian. Serving the most vulnerable is what the Bible tells us to do. I serve the most vulnerable, and that's our students who have, many of them who have don't have voices. The disabled students have always been pushed on the side. They don't have voices. I'm a voice for them. Our English learners who grew up from another country or parents who don't speak English, they struggle. I have empathy for them. I represent them because I was the same thing, right? Or parents, or if students that even come from broken homes, single parent homes, even no homes, foster youth.
Yeah,
I see. So I empathize for all of them because they're the ones that God has called us to truly love and care for. Yeah. And so people really have to realize that we should all be driven with that mission.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever. and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Yeah, I think it's a fair answer. You know, it's a fair answer. I think as long as we are driven by love,
yeah,
I think that's really, I always say that. I'm like, it's really nothing you should be extrapolating from the Quran, the Bible,
yeah,
any book,
yeah,
other than just love the guy, the girl next to you,
yeah,
and do it with all you can. I mean, and that alone is hard to do.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult directive. I feel like students, like your kids' age, my kids' age, are a lot smarter now, oftentimes, than teachers. And my brother tells me that because he's been teaching at the college level in Vietnam for close to 20 years now. And he says it's scary how smart and informed they are, more so than the teachers. What is the future of education when so many of them, I would say the privileged classes, are that far ahead, but you do see the majority of them not at that level. So there's this disparity.
Yeah.
How do we address all that?
So we address that through innovative practices, okay, innovation. We need to train our schools and our teachers in these innovative ways so that, to your point, so that they're able to educate the youth that have the information in their hand. Remember, the old way, or not the old way, traditional way of teaching certainly is to impart knowledge and new knowledge based on old knowledge, and then help kids to critically think about that. Well, the knowledge that most kids have now is on this phone, okay? But the phone doesn't teach kids to think critically. And the phone doesn't teach them to analyze the knowledge. That's why education and educators are still important. So we just have to catch up with the technology that's out there and be innovative. And so when we are innovative in the approaches, students engage. So let me just give an example. I know that many people criticize me for supporting charter schools. I have experience in both charter schools and traditional public schools. And they criticize me for that. And I say, why? Charter schools are all the charter schools are, they're public schools. They're just allowed to take an innovative, a different approach to the education they provide. Traditional schools can do that too. And we often find them doing that. And so the more we have a charter school in Santa Ana that really hits hard on developing a child's interest in in fine arts, visual arts, culinary arts, right? Well, why can't we have more of those schools? Because internationally, by the way, if you do a PISA study, or you look at PISA study, and they've done several years of this, that the schools that are most successful are the ones internationally, because what they do is they hone in on the kids' interests earlier on in their educational career, and they keep nurturing that throughout their educational career by giving them a pathway to meeting mentors, meeting experts in that field, and it begins to really stir that interest and knowledge in a child's education, right? Well, that's not typically how we do it in the United States. So we have to catch up with the innovation that's out there and learn more about it, like artificial intelligence, so that then we can actually provide it and help our kids think through it.
If we've been doing this for decades, doing it the traditional way, why are we still number one in the world when it comes to innovation and leading? And
That's a great question. Let's strip education from the innovation for a second, or from leading.
Separate them.
Yeah, let's separate them for a second. When we, in California alone, we've been doing education for a while, one out of two kids are failing. 50% of our kids are failing.
Wow.
In math and in reading. All right? Now, let's pause there for a second. Is that successful?
No.
Absolutely not. Even 90% is not successful. Would you go to a doctor, a surgeon, who's only 90% successful?
No.
Would you go fly on a plane when a pilot is 99% successful? No. We've always got to strive for 100%, and we're not even close to that. And so education in general, to your point, needs to be more innovative, needs to reach the hearts of our students so they can be engaged. Now, to answer your question, why do we lead the world in this? Because we have a lot of smart people from around the world who comes to the United States to actually do this work. Yes, we have a lot of smart people in the United States that do the work, of course. But in addition to that, we have really smart people around the world
coming here,
who've already gotten an education somewhere else, coming here because there's more opportunities. So that's why we lead the world in many of the...
So it's not really our citizens that are leading the country.
Well, I have to be careful to say that. Like I said, we have very smart citizens. I'm just saying that if we're failing half of our students, we have to really pause and think about that.
Will it ever get better?
Of course.
And I ask you that because when I think about our refugee experience, our sort of collective refugee Vietnamese experience, there's people like you who've gone through unspeakable hardships.
Yeah.
And there are other people who've gone through more hardships, but not as severe as your hardships. But those hardships create this sort of resiliency in the immigrant population, this refugee population, that drives the people of our community, Vietnamese people, to excel. And I'm not even going to get into the lineage of who we come from, you know, the officers, the elite of society in Vietnam. But going through difficulty is giving us all this sort of like this push. Now, I think second, third, fourth generations in America, when things are easy, I think that's why, that's just my weird theory, is that's why we're at 50%, because everybody's so darn comfortable with life.
Yes, I think that's definitely a factor, is that
we have no reason to push.
Well, yeah, so let me flip it. I think that that's one thing we need to do better at, is building resiliency in our students. Now, I would be criticized for saying that, but if you think about it, our children do need to be raised with challenges.
Yeah.
And they do need to be able to figure out those challenges on their own. And we as adults and educators need to support them as they overcome those challenges through helping them to make good decisions to overcome those challenges. Absolutely. But when what we've seen is kids, we have a whole generation of kids that they're used to this, the phone, they're not getting the immediate feedback about challenges they may be facing. They may be experiencing challenges, and then they look at people who are experiencing challenges, but there's no feedback and push to get through them. Instead, how do we deal with, this is like a drug.
It is a drug.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a drug for me.
It is. Of course, for me too. I binge watch movies on this thing, right? And so think about why people turn to drugs anyways. Because they have challenges that they're facing that they can't quite overcome, so they cope with drugs. Many of our youth, many challenges they face from a pandemic perspective and post, many emotional challenges. And so when you put this in front of them, this becomes their coping mechanism. Instead of adults that their parents, other peers, these are things you and I are used to growing up. We had our adults speaking into us. We had our family speaking into us. We had our peers speaking into us when we had challenges. So let me give you an example. When Jenna was going through those 6 years, okay, of battling cancer, my four kids saw every single moment all the way to her death, okay, or her passing. And how did they cope through that? They had a very loving dad and mom who supported them through that. They had a great school that worked through that. And then they had church friends, right, and congregants and members that really spoke into them and helped them through those challenges. Now, would I say that they're 100% healed? Absolutely not. They're going to be healing for the rest of their lives because of the passing of their mother. But at least they've been given tools and models on how to be resilient through something like that. And there is nothing worse for a child to go through than watching their parent, right, slowly die. Surgery after surgery, rehab after rehab, et cetera, et cetera. They had to experience everything. So that's my point with our youth today. I guess to get back to your point is that you're absolutely right, is that we need to build more resilient students because it's a very messy world, not a perfect world. And so if they get comfortable with this, they're not building that resilience. And so I think that your thesis is right on.
Yeah, and it's worrisome for the entire country because of how comfortable we as the United States have become. You know, if our generation is the next to lead the country, which we are, we're poised to lead the country, our generation, how ready are we when our parents' generation had gone through so much challenges, and not just in the Vietnamese community, but even in the American, white American community, they went through Vietnam, they went through, you know, arguably a lot of tough times. And here we are with the next generation of Americans. I mean, you could see it happening in China, Vietnam, Taiwan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, the more comfortable a country gets, the kids are now, I mean, in Japan, you know, they're bucking, you know, these, I mean, arguably it's not a good lifestyle to work that much in Japan.
Yeah.
But the country's no longer going to be at that level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I agree with you. Look, the challenges are still there in the world. And you know, we know humanity, that we have these challenges generation after generation. Just because technology has surpassed our challenges doesn't mean things are better.
Yeah.
Right? And so to your point, I think our generation, I think we're Gen X, we did have to go through a lot of challenges and we overcame them as our parents did. To your point, I think it's the current generation that I'm most concerned about. Yeah. And that's what educators need to focus on. And that is when we do social emotional learning, SEL, it's more about helping our kids to be resilient through those challenges that they face and overcome them. We can't push onto them how to overcome it. We can't give them all the answers. The more we give all of the answers and make it perfect for them, they're not going through those challenges. Yeah. So that's the controversy people have about me when it comes to SEL. They think that they think that, oh, you're not about the mental health counseling and stuff. I said, no, that's actually wrong. What I am about is developing within our youths the ability on their own to overcome the challenges they may face.
And that's lacking.
And that is lacking.
That's lacking big time, yeah.
Okay, so I get criticized for that on you know, whatever side it is.
But it's become a softer society. It's become a, I mean, it's not fair for me to say that because, you know,
have you read the book Coddling of the American Mind?
Yeah, I've heard of the book, yeah. I need to read it. I know the book.
It's exactly what you're saying. It's exactly what you're saying. And, you know, as an educator, I just, the focus should be on engaging our students in the interests that they love, giving them the support to do that, and then helping them to critically think so that they can overcome and make sense of the world around them.
But it's hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to not coddle our kids. It's very difficult.
It is.
You know, my partner right now is not the mother of my children. And she gives me a hard time about coddling my kids. And I know, and I tell her, you're right. You're absolutely right about your assessment.
Yeah.
Being an educator for multiple decades.
Yeah.
Telling me, who have no experience raising kids or educating them, she's right. Everything she's saying is right about me coddling them and... So it's a tough, I understand it. It's a very tough place to be. I wanted to know, have you ever went to look for your biological parents?
Yeah, I did a, what is that, 23andMe thing, right? Trying to locate to see if there are other people out there, other siblings. The results came back not favorable in terms of having other siblings. My adopted father went back to Vietnam a couple times to try to locate, and all he could find was the orphanage is still there. And in fact, he talked to some of the staff, and they remember that day, and they remember me, which is fascinating. And that was about 6 years ago. And so I told my adoptive father, I'm going to go back in the 50th anniversary and really do some research. And I think that's the way to do it, is go back to that orphanage, try to find the lineage. Unfortunately, it makes it more difficult because I was an orphan. And who knows who my parents were, frankly. It was during the Vietnam War. They couldn't care for a child who couldn't walk, obviously. But yes, I definitely have that interest. And that's what I plan to do when we go back next year, actually.
I could put you in touch with some people in that world.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Dr. Bean, thank you so much for today. I really enjoyed it. I was really looking forward to this. And thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. And thanks for having me, man.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.